Shayna, you started with an anecdote, and it's a very interesting anecdote, and so I thought it was a good idea to start my presentation, so I quickly readjusted. And the anecdote involves a woman also in the 1950s who was the widow of von Moltke, who was one of the ringleaders of the 20th of July conspiracy to assassinate the Führer, as you all know from the Valkyrie movie. So it's one of those characters around Tom Cruise. And he was executed. Von Moltke was there. He was caught. He was one of the 200 who was executed in the following days. He was a senior officer in the Wehrmacht, and his widow a few years later goes to the Bundeswehr, I'm not sure exactly what the name of the ministry was, claiming a pension. Her husband was a senior officer, and she felt she was entitled to that pension. And so she goes to the counter, and the clerk is going through the file, and that I'm sort of imagining, and he tells her, well, no, you can't, because he's a traitor. He was condemned as a traitor. He was executed, and you know, the law is very clear, you know, if you're and of course her reasoning, and this started a whole process, was, well, I mean, maybe he's a traitor by the standards of 1944, but he was, after all, trying to kill Hitler, and we've since learned a few things, and in sort of post-war Germany we tend to think that, you know, if 20th of July had succeeded, that would have been a great thing, and saved possibly thousands of lives. And so I think quite an interesting anecdote. It raises this issue of how do legal systems, in particular societies in transition, deal with people who are condemned by the previous oppressive regime for acts of resistance, sometimes condemned as traitors and sort of, you know, marked with infamy and considerable stigma. And so the project I've launched, and this is sort of very much work in progress, is on what I think is sort of a forgotten or slightly neglected theme in transitional justice issues, which is the idea of rehabilitation. How do societies rehabilitate traitors into heroes, traitors into resistors? And so I've been doing a bit of thinking about why this has been neglected. I'm not absolutely sure. I do see that in transitional justice, you know, there's been a very much a sort of victim-perpetrator dichotomy. So if we think of transitional justice as sort of studying particular roles in context of atrocities, this has really been the dichotomy, and then transitional justice has been thought in terms of repression of the perpetrators and maybe reparation or compensation of the victims, but there isn't really space, or as I think as much space as there should be in the field, for that sort of intermediary figure that is the resistor. And I think the resistor is in some ways an ambiguous figure. The resistor is a victim quite often. I mean, he's punished for having resisted, but he's the opposite of a passive, a pure victim in a sense. But the resistor can also be a perpetrator of his own excesses of violence occasionally. So I think my suspicion is the resistor is a bit too ambiguous a figure maybe for some of the sort of more clear-cut narratives of transitional justice. Maybe that's why the subject has been slightly avoided. I do think it raises the issue of rehabilitation raises very key questions for the way we conceptualize transitional justice. It's this sort of a reverse perpetrator question. I'll get into this in a minute, but if we do insist vis-a-vis perpetrators of atrocities that having followed orders since Nuremberg is not a defense, then we are suggesting that there's an obligation to resist in some cases. So what we do with resistors, in a sense, the flip side of how we deal with perpetrators of violence. And so what I'm hoping to do with this project is a sort of, you know, general study of rehabilitation that's both theoretical and empirical, although I probably never have time to do it, but it sounds like a good idea. Mostly from a legal point of view, but from a legally plural point of view. So I'm not only interested in the sort of a jurisprudence and the positive law of this, but also sort of culture and commemoration and how these things play into the law. So I'll give a few examples of that. You know, as a lawyer, I started thinking about this. Well, you know, rehabilitation, we have rehabilitation in domestic criminal law. I mean, and for, you know, you're condemned for an ordinary crime and you know, there can be such a thing as rehabilitation. I know from in my legal system in France, for example, after someone's death, you can actually get people rehabilitated, you know, 50 years, a century after the condemnation, there's a procedure for it. But rehabilitation for ordinary crimes is quite specific. Typically, you need to it's a sort of a revision of a condemnation. You need to introduce new facts, new evidence that wasn't available at the time. Now, I don't think in this project I refer to transitional justice rehabilitation, which I see as quite different from that ordinary rehabilitation, in that in transitional justice context, it's not that we suddenly discover something that we didn't know before. It's more that, you know, rehabilitation is in fact a rehabilitation of the whole legal system, of the whole system of justice at the time. And rehabilitation is therefore typically not simply individual, although it may also be that, but collective and generic. So in this today, I'll concentrate on sort of post Second World War, with an emphasis on Germany, because I think Germany has really had the most interesting experience in terms of rehabilitation and gone to sort of great depth in the jurisprudential dilemmas involved. Okay, so when does rehabilitation arise? So my starting point, looking at the German experience, is how extraordinarily slow rehabilitation has been. So the up to, and you would think, you know, Germany did a pretty good job of their transition overall. I mean, you know, lots of things changed after the war, but this was the one thing in the 1990s, a number of condemnations of people, for example, who'd been involved in the 20th of July conspiracy, but also other resistance movements in Germany, were still technically criminal, right? So criminal records had never been expunged. There was, as far as the law was concerned, they'd committed a crime under the Reich, and these condemnations were still valid. Now, partly, you know, this may be simply because no one bothered. I mean, you know, partly maybe these condemnations, there's a change of regime and people don't always feel the need to actually get their day in court and get their official rehabilitation. But still, these things tend to resurface after a while, and I'll show a few ways how, but the von Moltke's widow is an example. So I think I'm going to do three things. If I have time, I'll show what the obstacles were for rehabilitation, give a few ideas, and I'll give you a sense of the general movement of rehabilitation in post-war Germany. And I think there's a pattern, and I'm hoping when I do more comparative work to find a similar pattern in other transitional justice contexts and maybe be able to theorize this at one point. And then I'll mention a few of the jurisprudential dilemmas that arise in connection to rehabilitation, specifically in the context of transitional justice. All right, so obstacles first. What are the obstacles? Well, we've got the general obstacles of transitional justice that are not specific to rehabilitation, so we can leave those aside. Obviously, we need a society that's ready to re-examine its past, to deal with some of these issues. But I think there's, at least from a legal point of view, two specific obstacles to rehabilitation. The first obstacle is that rehabilitation involves looking back specifically at mistakes that were made by the legal system. It's, you know, the legal system judging it's what it did in the past. judging its own record. I mean, that's also arguably the case in other contexts, but I think it's particularly the case with rehabilitation. You need to undo these condemnations, and that's always going to be problematic for a legal system to sort of engage in that sort of criticism of its antecedents. The second thing, which is really, I think, quite important, is that rehabilitation of resistance is about legitimizing through the law disobedience, rebellion, and even what might be considered crime. It's about saying that in certain circumstances you really shouldn't follow the law because the law's been turned upside down and is completely wrong. And again, that, and well, very much so with the German legal system, that was a difficult conclusion to come to, and that's probably why it took so long. Now, the rehabilitation debate also plays out differently with different categories of resistors, and for some it's very tricky. So I want to give you a sense of who the beneficiaries of rehabilitation have been in post-war Germany. First, you have the simplest category is people who were involved in ordinary political activity that under the Nazis was considered a crime, but that wouldn't normally be considered a crime in any normal legal system. So people who just distributed leaflets, right, the White Rose, sort of executed for distributing leaflets. Well, the post-war Germany doesn't have a problem with that, you know, because clearly, you know, it wasn't something that could be considered wrong except under a totally distorted system like the Nazi one. Now, where things become a little more tricky is where the behavior is behavior that would normally be considered criminal, except that it's maybe excused by its motivation or by the context in which it occurred. So I'll give you three examples. First is obviously use of violence, okay, and particularly tyrannicide. You know, 23 attempts against Hitler's life, non-successful, but obviously for a legal system to uphold attempts against the life of a head of state is always going to be difficult, despite a long tradition of thought on tyrannicide. A second category of beneficiaries of rehabilitation that created lots of problems is deserters. And it's about 50,000 Wehrmacht deserters. Now, how do you deal with these people? The conservative argument, from sort of generals and the CDU was to say, well, it's a, you know, terribly bad example for our sort of post-war Germany. No army can survive encouraging desertion, and we really shouldn't rehabilitate deserters of the Wehrmacht. One of the arguments was, well, we can't tell whether they just deserted because they were cowards or real traitors, or because they had anti-Nazi feelings, right? And there's an argument against that. I'll get to that later. But you can see this in the Bundestag, lots of debates on this, and some, you know, old sort of Prussian type saying, well, they deserted their comrades, and, you know, they could have been protecting civilians against Allied advances. So it gets really quite passionate and intense. And then there's a third category that's really tricky. So far, the earlier categories were what I would call internal traitors. So they betrayed the Nazi system, but from within. Okay, but then we have a very sort of ambiguous category, which is external traitors, those who resisted the regime, but by entering in contact with the enemy, with the Allies, right? We know the 20th of July conspirators, for example, were in touch, you know, through various sort of secret means with London, saying they were going to do this, and, you know, it was all arranged, etc. And so that's a big taboo, right? Can you sort of resist your tyrant, but while cooperating with the enemy, and so, you know, money was transferred, and it becomes very complicated. All right, so. And the last obstacle is that whenever you're dealing with these rehabilitation issues, it seems as if you're talking about the past, but you're always talking about the present. And the present was East-West rivalry, the GDR wanting to say that the only real resistors were the communists, and the Federal Republic trying to draw legitimacy from the 20th of July conspiracy, the existence of a sort of liberal or conservative, whatever, German resistance against Nazism. All right, so there's a turn to rehabilitation. It's very slow. I won't go into the details. I'll just say one thing. It's preceded. All right, so there's two types of rehabilitation. So very quickly. So first, it's preceded by a lot of cultural steps, lots of issues of memorialization. There's for a creation, for example, of a monument to the deserters of the Wehrmacht. My advance is just the Green Party in Bremen, and it's kind of very contentious, etc. And plagues to Esser, who tried to assassinate Hitler in 1933, and all that quite controversial. And then we move to legal rehabilitation. Okay, and at first, and I distinguish between two types of legal rehabilitation. There's indirect and direct. Okay, direct is a little too complicated to begin with. So there's all kinds of indirect things that happen. One of them is the prosecution of people's courts of Nazi judges for all of their sort of judicial activity and saying, well, you know, it was just presented as justice and law, but really what it was murder. And in saying that they're guilty of using their judicial office for repression, you're indirectly rehabilitating the people they condemn. It's not quite the same thing, but it comes close. There's the pension cases, sort of administrative law issue, which I mentioned, and there's this for quite famous Remmer libel case. Remmer was one of the officers, he's in Valkyrie as well, who foiled the 20th of July plot, and he survived the war, formed a sort of neo-Nazi party in the 1950s, and one day said in a public meeting that all of the 20th of July conspirators were traitors. And he was prosecuted for libel. And so the question was, well, was he saying the truth, or was it a lie that was disparaging, you know, the truly heroic behavior of the conspirators? And he was eventually condemned to 3 months imprisonment for having disparaged von Stauffenberg and others. Okay, so these are the indirect sort of moves towards full rehabilitation. Then there's something more direct. To make a very long story short, there's an Allied Control Council order that supposedly nullifies all Nazi judgments, but in fact some still seem to have consequences and legal implications, you know, late in the 50s and 60s. It's eventually taken up in the parliament, and it's only by 1998 that a full law rehabilitates all people who are condemned by the people's courts, right? The crazy sort of Nazi pseudo court that condemned all, particularly all the resistors and dealt with political cases. All right, so and I've probably got 0 minutes left, so I'll be very very short. Jurisprudential dilemmas. Great. How does the system get out of all the contradictions that we're quite familiar with between sort of the positive law of the time and what might be considered sort of intemporal German law or international law, natural law, human rights law, some super legality that kind of you know, helps lawyers fit the pieces of a puzzle together. So one tactic that's used by German courts to begin with in the early days is to say, we're not going to go into the substance of whether they really did commit treason or not, but we're going to look at the procedure of a trial. And, you know, if we find that their rights were flagrantly denied, even, for example, by the very low standards of the Nazi legal system, then we'll consider that we'll annul that judgment. And that's a bit weak I think, because it doesn't tackle the real issue of substance. Then there's a big tension between individualized rehabilitation and collective rehabilitation, right? And so should we rehabilitate whole categories of people, or should everyone come and be forced to prove that they were actually they actually had political motives, for example, to desert the Wehrmacht? And obviously, whether you think everyone should get their day in court to get rehabilitation, or whether it's a blanket rehabilitation, depends on how salvageable you think the system was, right? Was the system sort of marginally capable of, you know, condemning deserters who were actually cowards? And then there's maybe an argument that, you know, that part should be more or less respected for the sake of, you know, the current political interest in Germany and a certain continuity of the law? Or do you think that any judgment rendered by Nazi courts is totally unreliable, and so the, you know, all deserters just deserve a blanket amnesty and compensation, etc.? Then there's a tension between, so one strategy is to look at criminal defenses rather than trying to broadly justify what the resistors did politically by saying, well, with the benefit of hindsight, we know they were on the right side of history. So, you know, let's just amnesty everyone, which is a political option. Or go for something a little more traditional, which is a criminal defense. And there, what you have is, particularly in relation to accusations of treason, okay, the technical formulation of treason is, in German law at the time, was treason must have been committed to jeopardize the well-being of a Reich. And so the trick there is to say, well, they didn't want to jeopardize the well-being of a Reich. They did, you know, share intelligence with the enemy, etc., but they did so for the good of the German people and to actually save the Reich from destruction, etc. So it's, you know, it's a bit of a, it's a bit of a trick, but it works in a way. And then the final degree in rehabilitating almost everyone is the sort of Radbruch formula, you know, Hart Fuller debate, saying the legal system doesn't even pass the test of a legal system at all. It was a perversion of a legal order. And then there's this sort of famous quote, and I'll finish with that, by one of the prosecutors in the Remmer case: injustice knows no treason, right? So you cannot betray injustice in a sense, or a betrayal of injustice is not something we would call betrayal. It's something we would call otherwise, and that is eminently worthy of full rehabilitation. So it's in that direction that the system has been going very slowly over the last 50 years. And I'm sort of amazed that it's taken that long. And just to finish, maybe a similar example is Switzerland and you know, the rehabilitation of Swiss border guards who let in Jewish refugees in violation of the instructions they'd been given. And it was only by the time they'd been given the status of righteous among nations that, you know, the Swiss took this up in sort of mid-1990s to symbolically rehabilitate these people whose careers had been broken and, you know, had finished in poverty, etc. So for me, it's it's almost like it's closing this very long cycle of transitional justice. And it's almost as if rehabilitation was the last thing that was done, but maybe not the least important. Sorry for taking a little more time.